From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Herb Alpert is equally at home with the art and the business of music. As a musician, he's had hits for over 25 years, in the 60s with the Tijuana Brass, and recently with Janet Jackson. Alpert also co-founded A&M Records, one of today's top labels. Herb Alpert discusses his music and the record industry on this edition of Fresh Air. We also meet writer Howard Cohn. As a young man, he left the family farm and became an investigative reporter. Cohn's new book is a memoir chronicling his debate over whether or not to return home to preserve the farm after his father grew too old to work it. And jazz pianist Dick Hyman plays the music of Teddy Wilson and talks about Wilson's influence. That and more on this edition of Fresh Air. Herb Alpert, a well-known name that has different associations for different generations. In the 1960s, trumpeter Herb Alpert headed the Tijuana Brass, playing pop music with a Mexican tinge. The group was so popular that in 1966 alone, it had 7 tunes in the top 40. The first Tijuana Brass record, The Lonely Bull, was recorded by Alpert and his partner Jerry Moss on their fledgling independent label A&M. The success of the Tijuana Brass helped build A&M into one of the most successful independent labels in the U.S. In the past few years, their artists have included Janet Jackson, Suzanne Vega, Sting, and the Go-Go's. Alpert is now the co-chair of A&M. As for Alpert's performing career, he had a number one hit in 1968 with This Guy's in Love with You. He was off the charts for the next 11 years, but in 1979, his disco instrumental Rise made it to number one. Last year, he had a big dance hit with Diamonds, which also featured singer Janet Jackson. Alpert's recording career is taking another turn with his new album, Under a Spanish Moon. It includes a suite in 3 movements for trumpet and orchestra, written for him by George Del Barrio. Of course, it's on A&M Records. Here's the opening of the suite. It's Herb Alpert from his new album, Under a Spanish Moon. Herb Alpert, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is a different kind of sound for you. Does it reflect a changing interest on your part?
No, not a changing interest, just a change. I like searching for new sounds and new people to work with, play with. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, as I was listening to that, it's strange how commercial a sound can feel once you've heard it over and over. I know this kind of doesn't really make sense to think that particular record could sound great on top 40 radio, but it sounds like a hit record to me.
Well, you know, I wanted to know if you had a track from your suite that you thought of as the single.
We just heard it.
Oh, good, okay.
Well, I mean, I know that's not down the pipeline. I guess the song that Sting wrote, Fragile, would be more suited for pop radio, but I have a feeling that everyone out there is looking for something new now. There's a lot of sameness out there. We hear a lot of records that just kind of are like clones of each other. And it feels like it's time for that real left fielder, the one that's just coming way out of the blue.
Well, this is something you commissioned, right? This piece?
I commissioned George Del Barrio, a wonderful Argentinian composer. He wrote a suite for me that was part of a concert that I performed last summer with various symphony orchestras across the country.
I have a feeling that you have several different audiences and that they're each unaware of a different aspect of your work. For instance, that your Tijuana Brass audience doesn't know about your records Rise and Diamonds, and that you might develop a completely different audience with your new record, and that the people who know you from your disco and funk hits probably don't know the Tijuana Brass stuff. Have you found that to be true?
You're absolutely right on target. That's exactly what has happened. It's kind of odd in a way, because I run into people who are very familiar with the Tijuana Brass, and they say, "Hey, what, Herb, what you been doing lately? I mean, have you retired?" I said, "No, wait a minute. Haven't you heard Rise? No, what's that?" You know, so they relate to the Tijuana Brass. The folks that, relate to Rise, most of those people never heard about the Tijuana Brass. And then this last album I did prior to Under a Spanish Moon, Keep Your Eye on Me, was a big urban record. So they weren't aware. Well, I guess most of those people were aware of Rise, but certainly the Tijuana Brass was not in their memory.
Is it hard to get instrumental singles on the charts now? Is it hard to get instrumentals on?
It always was hard because it's not giving people really enough information. It's easier when you say, "Who looks at you the way I do?" And that's, you can conjure up all sorts of images with that one. But when you're just blowing, a horn and a melody, it's much tougher.
I want to play an excerpt of Rise, which made it to number one in 1979. And this was your first record on the charts in around 10 years, right?
Well, it was the first... let's see, since... the thing that pleased me so much about Rise, it was the first instrumental number one record I had, and also mm-hmm. I have the distinction of having the only vocal and instrumental number one record.
Now, this was kind of at the end of the disco era, and I was wondering if you were initially comfortable with the kind of backing that you had on this, with the production style on it.
Well, you should have heard the way it started out. It was much different. My nephew said to me, he says, "Uncle, why don't you take Tijuana Taxi and Taste of Honey and some of the evergreens, Spanish Flea, and make a disco record out of them. You know, make them dance." I said, "Well, I don't think it would feel right, but let me give me an idea what you have in mind." So we went into the studio, and we got the musicians together, and we started playing Taste of Honey and dance version of Taste of Honey. And 10 minutes into the session, I started to get nauseous. It just didn't feel right. So we passed on that idea, and I said, "Do you have any other thoughts?" And he said, "Well, I have this, tape of songs that you might like." And on that tape was a song called, it was nameless, but the song Rise was on that tape. And I had this idea of recording a record that would be different than the ones that were out there at the particular moment. Most of the records were programmed between 120 and 135 beats per minute for a particular, dance sequence. So I thought, wouldn't it be nice to come up with something a little bit slower that when people get tired of dancing apart, they can get together and dance? And that was the concept behind Rise. And I never thought of it as a disco dance record per se. I just thought it was, just a nice record.
Let's hear it. This is Rise, featuring my guest Herb Alpert on trumpet. You know, the funny thing is, in some ways, that's not very different from the kind of stuff Miles Davis was recording at the time.
Well, Miles is always trying something new, too. He's always searching and picking, and I really admire his career. He's one of the trumpet players that sparked me years ago, and I really admire what he does.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Herb Alpert, and he has a new record out that's called Under a Spanish Moon and features a suite that he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. Herb Alpert is also the A in A&M Records. How did you start listening to jazz? I figure that's what you started off listening to.
Well, no, actually, I started listening to classical music. I started playing the trumpet when I was 8, and I was with junior symphony orchestras while I was in my teens. In the Army, I picked up a record by the late, great Clifford Brown, and that was a moment that was very important for me. I was amazed by his dexterity and his ability to express himself. And from then, I started listening to Miles and Dizzy Gillespie, and I became a jazz fan. I think jazz is the real art form. It's amazing what can be created with no thought. You know, if you just use a blank canvas, close your eyes, you have your palette and as your toolkit, but for the most part, you're just responding to feelings. And it's a beautiful way to communicate.
Before you actually started your recording career, you had a very, very, very brief career as an actor. And if I have this correct, you were an extra on The Ten Commandments?
Well, I was an extra on many movies.
Oh, really?
I used to earn my living by, you know, just pretending I was playing trumpet or some type of strange instrument behind, you know, the scenes while the actual score was being played. I did play, I was on The Ten Commandments. I worked on the picture for about 3 months, actually.
Which scenes were you in?
Well, the scene where you can recognize the mole on my back is when Moses was coming down the mountain with the Ten Commandments. There was the party. They were idolizing the golden calf, and the scene actually opened on my back. And I asked Cecil B. DeMille, I turned around and said, "Do you mind if it opens on my face?" And he said, "Not this time, son."
That's really terrific. So did you not like the life of an extra?
Well, it was just a means to another end. It was just a way of earning a living. It was certainly a nice eye-opener to that area. But I studied acting with Jeff Corey for about a year. I also studied with Leonard Nimoy. And I enjoyed the experience, but I realized that I'm not a born actor. I think it's a whole other field. And just because you might look like you're able to act doesn't really give you the tools.
In the recording industry, you started out as an A&R man, which is what producers used to be called. That stands for Artists in Repertoire. And one of the first records that you produced was a cover recording of Alley Oop, which was a novelty hit in 1960. And the Hollywood Argyles had the number one version. You produced the cover that went to number 15 by Dante and Evergreen. I'll tell you the truth, I don't remember the cover version of it. I remember the hit. But would you explain what the philosophy was then behind doing covers of songs?
Well, in those days, there were a lot of records that were recorded, and other artists would either, you know, hear the song, get excited about it, and re-record, you know, the very same version. You know, Hank Ballard wrote The Twist and recorded The Twist, and a couple of months later, Chubby Checker recorded it, re-recorded the same version, and as we all know, you know, that's been a hit 3 times already. It was quite prevalent in those days. What happened was the Hollywood Argyles had this record on the West Coast, and my partner at the time, Lou Adler, and I were talking to the company we were working for in New York and asked them if they liked Alley Oop, and they had never heard of it. So that Alley Oop was already number one in Los Angeles, so we said, well, we'll send you another version of it. And the next day, we recorded it that afternoon, and the next day it was out in New York City, and it sold 230,000 records just in that area.
Oh, so they had the West Coast version, you had the East Coast version.
That was it, yeah. It's kind of a dirty thing to do, and I'd never do it again, and it's something I'm not really proud of. I don't think it's fair to do, but it was done in those days, and I didn't think twice about it because I really wasn't able to stand back and take a few beats and realize what we were doing.
Now, I want to talk to you about how you got into the studio yourself and about beginning your own recording career. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is trumpeter Herb Alpert, who has a new record called Under a Spanish Moon that features a suite that he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. And Herb Alpert is also the A in A&M Records, which is one of the top, if not the top, independent record companies in America. We'll talk more about his recording career after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Herb Alpert is my guest, and I think most Americans were introduced to you through your work with the Tijuana Brass, which is a group that you founded and led just about throughout the 60s. The first record that you did was also the first record for A&M Records, and it was The Lonely Bull, which was a song that was written by a friend of yours under a different name, but you recorded with a Spanish tinge. How did it end up happening that way?
Well, it was it all came about after a bullfight, my very first bullfight that I saw in Tijuana in 1962, and I was taken in by that, the feeling of that afternoon, and I tried to translate the sight into a sound. And my friend had this melody that I loved very much. It was written, he gave me a demo of it, and he had it recorded on a celeste, and it was very ethereal. But I thought the melody was much more powerful than the way he had presented it to me. And it just fit this mood that I felt would best translate this afternoon that I experienced.
Let me just play a few seconds of that, refresh our memories, and then we'll talk some more. This is Herb Alpert's first recording as Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, and this is The Lonely Bull. Whose idea was the sound effects at the beginning?
Well, the sound effects actually is taken from the Tijuana Bullring. An engineer friend of mine went down there with a tape machine and captured the spirit. I mean, it talking about instrumental records, they're so hard to get played that I felt that we needed. In those days, we used to talk about where's the hook of the record. You know, when's the bridge coming? Where's that thing you can remember? You know, and I felt like we needed that hook right from the get-go. And when the Olays came in, I think the record was over. People, I know I liked it the moment I heard it.
Well, this record went to number 6 on the charts in 1962 and led to just a slew of hits for you with this Latin-tinged ensemble. And I was wondering if you ever thought about what you were tapping into in the American public to have this sound hit so big.
No, I really don't know. It was I was just choosing songs that appealed to me, and I was very... I was very much into it. I was recording with my heart. It wasn't something I wasn't turning out buttons. I wasn't trying to capitalize on the momentum. I was having fun in the studio, and when I felt good about a recording, that it would make the album, and that was my measure.
It was a very interesting time on the charts in the sense that you had we had Phil Spector records and the Beatles, coinciding with instrumental pop, like the Tijuana Brass. Do you know what I mean? It was quite a diverse mix, making it into the top 10.
Yeah, there were some really fun things happening sonically with records in the 60s, mid-60s especially. The thing that got me going was, prior to the 60s, we heard the great records of Les Paul and Mary Ford, and where Les Paul used to take his guitar and overdub on top of his own sound 3, 4, 10 times. And I started doing that with the trumpet in my little garage in West Hollywood. And I arrived on this sound of the Tijuana Brass. That's the sound of my horn, multiplied.
In different channels, right?
On different channels. And also, when I played them, I had this feeling of being another person as well. Instead of trying to duplicate exactly what I was playing the first time around, I was pretending to be the second trumpet player or the third trumpet player or the fourth trumpet player, depending on how many trumpets I stacked.
Did your listeners presume that you were Latin?
I guess the public did for a while. It wasn't intended to be misleading, but I guess they did because of the name. And every now and then I tell folks that my father was born in Tijuana and moved to Russia when he was a small kid. Kind of gets a laugh.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, the records that you made with the Tijuana Brass really helped build A&M Records. The A was for Alpert, the M for Jerry Moss, your partner. Did you have a marketing design that worked especially well when you were first getting started? It's very hard for a fledgling label to succeed in the way that yours did.
Right. Well, we did have a concept. It was a modest one, but it was an honest one. We noticed that the records that were being put out in that particular period, most of the companies would take a hit record, and they'd surround it by 11 other sides, and they'd call it, you know, the title would be the name of the hit record, and then you'd buy the record, and you'd, for the most part, be disappointed because you wouldn't find much else in that, in the disc, to listen to. So we decided to make every one count. You know, we'd spend as much time on cut two and three and four as we did on the premier cut. So we tried to make a record that we would stop our car and go to the record shop to buy ourselves. And that was essentially the concept.
Well, early on in A&M, you had artists like Sergio Mendez and Chris Montez. And then by the late 60s, you were adding rock groups like the Procol Harum, Joe Cocker. More recently, the Go-Go's, Janet Jackson, Sting. It seems like there was a big turn in A&M from more pop-oriented music to more rock-oriented music. I was wondering what was responsible for the shift.
Well, we just went through different roads. We had the very first rock group. Actually, it was the Wee Five out of San Francisco.
You Were On My Mind, their big hit.
Exactly, and that was our first number one record.
Uh-huh.
We noticed that we just had to spread our wings. You know, we had a reputation as being a middle-of-the-road company for a long time, and then we just had to open up a few more windows, and we did, and it's just it's been growing ever since, and it's been growing gracefully and with the same dedication that Jerry and I put into it in 1962. And we're fortunate in having a tremendous staff of people that reflect the same attitude that we had when we started the company.
Herb Alpert is my guest, trumpeter and the head of A&M Records. He's the A in A&M. The M is his partner, Jerry Moss. And Herb Alpert has a new album called Under a Spanish Moon that features a suite that he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. Could you make decisions based on your own taste once the label headed in a more rock-oriented direction?
Well, absolutely. But, as we started growing, I realized that if I was in complete control of our artist roster, we'd probably have 10 artists. So I had to give up some of that, give up part of my biases and grow with other people's feelings as well.
Last year you had a big hit with Diamonds, which also featured singer Janet Jackson, who's one of the many members of the Jackson family. And the record was produced by her producers Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Now, she records for A&M. And I was wondering how this record came about. I think you asked Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis to do something for you?
Well, I jokingly asked them. We were presenting Janet with a platinum record, and we were taking pictures on the A&M lot. And I looked at Jimmy and I said, do you guys ever try and produce an instrumental artist? And they said, yeah. I mean, no, but we'd like to try it. So one thing led to another, and, we got together. And it was their idea to use Janet. I was really hesitant because I didn't want it to seem like, I was trying to pad my deck too hard. But, in a way, that record backlashed for me because although it was a big hit record, the very first instrumental that came out was the title song, Keep Your Eye on Me. And it was really starting to, catch a lot of momentum, and it did sell rather well, but the radio land out there, they were so intrigued by Diamonds that they wouldn't get off it, and they wanted us to release Diamonds, so we had to release Diamonds on top of the momentum that we were getting with Keep Your Eye on Me. And I think Keep Your Eye on Me might have been a bigger record had Janet not participated in the record, and I'm not, complaining that she was on it. I'm just saying there was a strange backlash.
So you think vocals frequently overshadow the instrumental part in a record?
Well, I think they just absolutely do. But of course, at that time, Janet was so hot and people couldn't get enough of her
because right.
her Control album was going crazy and people just wanted to hear more Janet Jackson.
Well, I'm going to play an excerpt of that record. We'll play the part where you solo on Diamonds.
Great.
Herb Alpert from his hit of last year.
That's fun. I haven't heard that in a while. That makes your head move. You know, when I was playing the trumpet in the studio, at one point Jimmy Jam came out in the studio and he says, "Man, you gotta move. You gotta move." You know, so like I'm playing the horn and while we're recording, he's actually dancing around the studio, giving me, you know, like all the body language.
Well, it's funny, you know, you're recording with a generation much younger than you are.
Well, not really. I mean, music is music. You know, I think Sam Cooke taught me the greatest lesson of all. He said, "Look, man, it either makes it or it don't. Nobody cares how old you are, you know, what type of trumpet you're using, you know, how long you've practiced, what echo chamber, what engine. It's not important. It either works or it doesn't, and that's the measure."
Let me ask you a question about A&M. You're still an independent record company, although you're distributed by RCA now. Have there been offers to buy you up, offers by bigger companies or conglomerates, and what's the importance to you of remaining an independent company?
Oh, we've had offers through the years, and it's, you know, we bat them off. Well, we like to be independent because we're able to make our own decisions. I can't see being in a room filled with 30 people and taking a vote on whether a record should be released or not, or, you know, it just makes it so much nicer for us to conduct our business the way we see fit.
How often do you report to the office?
Well, I don't report in that sense. I just, you know, do what feels right for me, because I'm in that position now.
Do you keep all of your records in print?
What do you mean by that?
All of the Tijuana Brass records and all the records under your name. Do you keep them in print since they're on your label?
No, there are some cutouts. There are some records that didn't do well. But for the most part, most are available. Most of the Tijuana Brass records are available.
Okay. Well, listen.
And especially now with CD. You know, CD has been a great windfall for the record industry. So a lot of, you know, records have been resurrected because of CDs.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us a little bit about your life and your music. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Terry.
My guest has been trumpeter Herb Alpert, who's also the head of A&M Records. And his own new record is called Under a Spanish Moon, and it features a suite he commissioned for trumpet and orchestra. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Los Angeles Times Washington correspondent Doyle McManus. He's the co-author of the new book Landslide. It investigates the inside workings of the White House during the Reagan presidency. And the book portrays Reagan as an indecisive and disengaged leader whose staff and cabinet operated independently of him. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Howard Cohn left the family farm as soon as he came of age. His work as an investigative reporter kept him far from home, and he was thankful for it. On today's Fresh Air, Cohn discusses returning home to the farm and reconciling with his parents and their way of life. It's the subject of his new memoir, The Last Farmer. Also, jazz pianist Dick Hyman is back to talk about the influence of Teddy Wilson and to play some of Wilson's music. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone has a review of the work of Nicholas Nixon, a photographer working in the tradition of social photographers like Dorothea Lange. Nixon's work is now on exhibit at New York's Museum of Modern Art. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. An Israeli newspaper reported today that the U.S. has struck a secret deal with Iran, promising aid and arms sales in exchange for the release of 9 U.S. and British hostages. President Reagan denied the report, carried in the English-language weekly, The Nation. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, however, left open the possibility that a third party was holding talks with Iran in an effort to release the hostages. A federal judge in Texas today found the FBI guilty of discrimination in its treatment of Hispanics. During a 2-week non-jury trial, about 30 agents testified that Hispanic agents are given less desirable assignments, are afforded less recognition for their successes, and are not promoted as quickly as non-Hispanics. U.S. District Judge Lucius Bunton agreed with 311 Hispanic agents who sued the FBI because of unfair working conditions and promotions policies. Benton said the issue of damages will be decided in later hearings, possibly beginning in late November. A major shakeup today at the Communist Party hierarchy in Moscow. It's the largest since General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev came to power 3.5 years ago. 79-year-old President Andrei Gromyko and 4 other veteran leaders will vacate their long-held positions of power. NPR's Ann Cooper has more from the Soviet capital.
Today's meeting of the Party Central Committee was called in haste, ostensibly to talk about overhauling the country's huge party bureaucracy. But the overhaul was overshadowed by a flurry of high-level changes that sent 5 party leaders into retirement and promoted 4 others. Besides Gromyko, those retired today included Politburo member Mikhail Solomonsev and Anatoly Dobrynin, the former ambassador to the United States. None of the departures was a real surprise. Gorbachev is anxious to infuse new blood in the party leadership because he's increasingly exasperated with the party's role in carrying out perestroika, his catch-all term for economic and social change. There's no guarantee that today's moves will actually boost perestroika, but the leadership lineup now looks more favorable than ever for Gorbachev. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The U.S. Southern Command, America's military headquarters for the Southern Hemisphere, is protesting Panama's seizure of U.S. military supplies yesterday. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
When Panamanian officials inspected several sealed containers unloaded in the civilian port of Las Minas, they found 2 5-ton trucks and 1 121-millimeter tank turret tube. Panamanian Attorney General Carlos Villalaz said the attempted delivery of military equipment violated the Panama Canal Treaty. Panama forbids ships carrying arms into that port because it is also a major oil refinery. The Panamanians also charged that the supplies may have been destined for forces opposed to General Manuel Noriega. At the State Department today, spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley denied the charge.
Nothing in the Canal Treaty or related agreements prevents the U.S. from receiving shipments of military supplies or equipment through this port. There was nothing unusual about this shipment. In fact, shipments of military supplies have now taken place through this port for a number of years.
The incident marks the first time Panama has confiscated U.S. military equipment. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Pope John Paul II today said that while women are equal to men before God, only men are entitled to be Roman Catholic priests. The pontiff's ruling states that since the first priests, Jesus' apostles, were all men, it's God's will that all priests be men. He also said that women's fundamental characteristics were different than men's, that the female personality is essentially formed by maternal instincts. At least 60 people were killed, more than 100 wounded today, when gunmen opened fire on crowds in a city in southern Pakistan. Witnesses say that shooting was indiscriminate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones lost 6 points, closing 21.12.91. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For the last few weeks, jazz pianist and composer Dick Hyman has played us through a history of boogie, ragtime, and stride piano styles. Today he concludes this series with a look at the great swing pianist Teddy Wilson. Wilson's elegant playing and prodigious technique influenced many pianists, including a young Dick Hyman.
I won a jazz piano competition that was being given by a local radio station in New York City. And one night I went down and did my thing, and lo and behold, the prize was 12 lessons with Teddy Wilson. So I began to visit him and learned a lot from him, both as a player and as a man, and stayed in touch with him until he died, regrettably, only about, three or four years ago. Teddy was a pianist of great elegance and clarity. He was about, I would say, the opposite of a pianist such as Errol Garner. He played lightly, he played fewer notes, and the lines that he played were very, very much like a clarinet. Which is why I think he fit in so beautifully with Benny Goodman in all of those hundreds of jazz classics that they recorded in the 1930s and 40s and even after. When he was playing solo, that is to say without a rhythm section accompanying him, he had a left hand which was based on what pianists call a walking or a tenth. It was a kind of a stride bass, but it was less percussive than other kinds of stride players would use. Teddy was not really a stride player at all from that definition, but he used a great deal of this. And he would throw in runs now and then of a rather surprising technique, like a and it came together something like this. Here is a song that Teddy recorded at one time in the 1930s when he and Billie Holiday were producing some great recordings. This is how Teddy, in my estimation, might have done it if he had been recording it as a solo piano piece. The tune is a nice old song called I'll Get By. Thank you. That is my impression of the way Teddy might have played that song. And I tried to put in the walking bass, the tenths, the single line runs, the occasional octave tremolos, and the works. The swing was always there. Teddy was a swing pianist, really, by definition, and maybe the best.
Dick Hyman is a pianist, composer, and arranger based in New York. In addition to performing, Dick Hyman composes and arranges for movies. He's done the scores for Moonstruck, Zelig, and The Purple Rose of Cairo, and played on the soundtracks for several Woody Allen films. This is Fresh Air. Howard Cohn was born on a small farm in Michigan and started working in the fields with his father when he was six. As the oldest son, he was expected to take over the farm. But Cohn had his own ideas about the future. He left the farm when he turned 18 and went to the University of Michigan, where he was active in the anti-war movement. Cohn went on to become an investigative journalist for Rolling Stone, covering such stories as Patty Hearst's underground flight and the death of union organizer Karen Silkwood. A family crisis recently forced Cohn to return home and to confront his responsibility to his parents and the farm. That's the subject of his memoir, The Last Farmer. Cohn remembers that he'd already grown apart from his father when he first left home as a young man.
I felt I'd made the right decision. I felt my father, by continuing in what I considered a backward method of farming, being content to stay on his 120 acres, having no real ambition to be a modern farmer, that he was wrong and I was right. And I was ready to get out, ready to chase the bright lights, ready to live a completely different life. And the guilt that I eventually felt didn't come about for some years.
What initiated your recent series of trips back to the farm, the series of trips that you write about in your new memoir?
My father's health began to fail in 1982 and 83. He had a heart attack. He fell off the roof of the house, broke his back, and his blood pressure went up to the point where his doctors thought he was a real candidate for a fatal heart attack. My mother was very concerned. She wrote to me. And he had also had a falling out with a cousin of mine who had been helping him out on the farm. So he was at a position in bad health, no one to help him, and really impossible for him to carry on by himself. My mother very concerned, afraid that she was going to be left a widow. And I, too, suddenly realized that my father could die at any time, any day. And whatever was between us, all the hard times, the hard feelings, the differences, would never be resolved, never be faced. And I didn't want to be in a position of coming home to my father's funeral with suddenly regretting 20 years of never speaking to him or never speaking directly to him.
I think one thing that gives a sense of how the farm was run is that your parents had no credit line, no credit cards, not even a checkbook.
That's right.
It's the opposite of big business farming.
It was cash and carry. He'd come out of the Great Depression, and that had formed him in many ways. An uncle of his had committed suicide, having gone into debt, not been able to pay off his debts. His grandfather, which I didn't write about in the book out of some consideration for my father, but of begun to talk about anyway because my sister thinks it's important to be said. My great-grandfather had gone to prison during the Great Depression for committing arson, trying to collect insurance again because he'd fallen into debt. So my father, from that period on, just lived to stay out of debt and never once bought anything on credit.
When you went back to the farm to be with your parents, you realized, and they realized, that there were basically three alternatives. Your father could keep working the farm, but that would really jeopardize his health. He could bring on a sharecropper, which he didn't really want to do, or he could sell it. But it occurred to you that there was a fourth alternative, which is that you could move back to the farm and play the role of the elder son and take over the farm. How seriously did you ever consider that?
I thought of it very seriously, which shocked me and shocked my wife, that I would actually entertain the idea, because it was such a foreign idea. I'm not truly a farmer, but I felt strongly that I needed to come to terms with my father, and that seemed one way to do it. I felt also just a tremendous sense of loss when I realized that the farm might be sold and that the family home, as it were, would disappear. Now, eventually, I decided not to do it, or perhaps it's more accurate to say my father decided that for the sake of his family, for the sake of his health, for the sake of our collective well-being, that he would sell.
Before your father decided to sell the farm when you were still agonizing over the decision about whether to take over the farm yourself, you were faced with a dilemma that I think a lot of people in their 30s and 40s are faced with, and that is, do you inhabit the life of your parents to preserve what they worked so hard to build, or do you keep in the life that you made for yourself, but risk seeing something that they build pass?
Yes, that's exactly the dilemma, that caught in having to give up something to gain something else, that the life that I had with my wife and now with my daughter is, in fact, the life I want, the life that I'd worked for. And yet, to see my father's life and, by extension, the life that had existed for more than 100 years on that piece of land. The Cohn family had been there since the 1870s. My grandfather, my great-grandfather had worked it. We'd all walked up and down those same fields. To see that pass into the hands of strangers, some corporation, It was more than I could bear at times, and I kept running around in circles, literally going back and forth between my home in Washington and the farm in Michigan.
Our generation was, I think, the generation that had the most violent upheavals in their family, with their parents, and where there were these just terrible breakups between parent and children as the children left home and took on lifestyles that were considered radical and dangerous by the parents. And now I see around me reconciliations going on, like yours, for instance.
Mm-hmm. And that's true of a number of my friends who've just reached a certain age and realized that, well, they realized two things. They realized that there was a lot of their fathers in them. And I realized that. And they also realized that time was running out. And if you didn't do something now, there wouldn't be any time left.
Do you have a good relationship with your parents now?
I do. I have a good relationship. We still don't express our feelings in words. I've tried to say I love you to my father and never quite managed to say it. And he hasn't said that to me either. But I was home recently. In fact, I brought him a copy of the book. And what he said to me, he said nothing when I handed him the book. But what he had instead was a pile of wood waiting for me. And we spent 4 or 5 hours chopping it up. And that was his way of saying welcome home. It said all I needed to hear.
And has he accepted you? I mean, you were, I assume, something of a problem to him.
I was something of a black sheep, but I found this out when I was writing the book, and I found it out from my younger brothers. I found out that when I was off being the prodigal son, being an anti-war radical, a student protester, making headlines for all the things that my father didn't like, that he, in fact, was back in the Saginaw Valley of Michigan defending me to his friends and neighbors and my aunts and uncles, and saying that whatever else, I was still his son. And I didn't know that at the time. I had no idea that he was saying that. 20 years later, when I found it out, I cried.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Howard Cohn is the author of The Last Farmer, an American memoir. When Cohn's parents sold their farm, they kept their house and 1 acre of land. They have a garden that produces enough for themselves, with plenty left over for the local farmer's market. This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead to All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, our top story is that heads are rolling in the Kremlin. Andrei Gromyko has resigned, also several other top-level conservative officials, and all of this is presumed to be in Mikhail Gorbachev's interests. Also, we look at the rise and fall of Neville Chamberlain. He was the British prime minister who, in 1938, went to Germany, met with Hitler, came away with an agreement 50 years ago today, giving away part of Czechoslovakia in exchange for what some then called peace in our time. Well, we know history from our history that it turned out to be a worthless agreement. Hitler invaded Poland less than a year later, and thus began World War II.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Photographer Nicholas Nixon works in the tradition of the social realist photographers. His photos of the aged and ill are intended to provoke indignation and action. The Museum of Modern Art in New York City is now exhibiting Nixon's work from the last 10 years. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has this review.
In 1983, photographer Nicholas Nixon began shooting portraits of old people in nursing homes. In 1987, he started taking pictures of people with AIDS. These two series are currently mounted in his show at the Museum of Modern Art, which will be touring the country for the next 2 years. These pictures are startling, bold, and painful. An old man, identified as CC, is photographed in profile. The flesh on his cheek stretches achingly toward earth. The eye we can see is nearly closed, encased in its socket, a bony carapace that looks so prominent because the eye has receded. The only adornment aging has left is a thin curtain of white hair that flows down his skull, delicate as the feathers of a crane. The face of another patient, AI, a woman, is scored with lines that crisscross in every direction. Her skin looks like a topographic map, but around her set mouth is the suggestion of a smile, some sensation of pleasure that has cast her and remains intact. FH, a man, hasn't been so spared. He stares from eyes circled with lines and bristly brows, eyes that scream with terrible knowledge. The AIDS pictures are even more harrowing, because the same degeneration is happening to young people. Nixon's practice is to shoot ill people every few weeks, so we see the progress of their disease on the flesh and on their emotions. The most detailed series, which includes 12 portraits, is of Tom Moran from the Boston area. The photographs begin in August 1987 and end in February 1988, shortly before Moran's death. In the first one, his affectionate mother presses her face against her son's and cups his thin cheek in her hand while he stares out, partially smiling and making direct contact with the photographer. He is holding himself in the world of the adult living. In October 87, he observes his bony, unclothed chest in the bathroom mirror, and he looks boyish and brave. By January, he is far thinner, and sadness and resignation overwhelm him. A few days later, he looks cadaverous, wasted, far away. But in the last shot, his mouth infected with thrush, he again meets the photographer's gaze, bidding farewell tearlessly but intimately. Part of the power of these pictures comes from Nixon's unsentimental and fearless contact with his subjects. He neither sentimentalizes nor intrudes. He bears witness, reminding us how hard this is to do and how important it is, so we do not lose contact with the reality of death and those nearing it. A large portion of the hysteria people feel about AIDS comes from the fact that the disease reminds us, more potently than the abstraction of nuclear war, that we will all someday die, regardless of how much or little sex we have, of whether we live in the suburbs or the city. We don't want this consciousness. Nothing in our culture prepares us for it. As post-war North Americans, we grew up in the age of medical miracles, the end of polio, diphtheria, TB, measles. We thought freedom from worry was our birthright. We don't see the very aged, who are now often shunted into nursing homes. Like the Names Project quilt, Nixon's photographs help train us to live with the message of mortality without shunning those who carry it. They help teach us to tolerate long-term uncertainty without leaping to simple explanations that lighten anxiety but don't touch its root cause, our existence as vulnerable human beings. Nixon's camera makes that vulnerability palpable, knowable, and therefore less terrifying and strange.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Nicholas Nixon's show runs through November 13th. Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. Next time I speak with journalist Nick Toshis. He's best known for Hellfire, his highly praised biography of rock and roller Jerry Lee Lewis. His new novel, Cut Numbers, is about small-time numbers runners and loan sharks and their schemes to make it big. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by drummer and composer Jack DeJohnette. And television critic David Bianculli previews two made-for-TV movies about Liberace, the flamboyant entertainer who died last year. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton. Production assistance from Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.